start with Senate Bill 1011, then we're going to move to House Bill 2051, then we're going to finish with Senate Bill 235. We have five and maybe one more sign-up sheet coming, six sheets of people to testify today, all important issues. The first two bills we're going to hear, 1011 and 2051, we are not going to move to a work session today, which means there will not be a vote on those bills. We're going to be taking public testimony only. They're both important bills, so I don't want to cut anybody off. But because the other bill we have, 235, has got a lot of people to testify, it's also an important bill, and it is going to a vote today. I would appreciate everybody who testifies on the first two to keep your remarks as brief and pertinent as possible so that we can get through as many people as possible. If it starts getting late in the hour, I'll have to shut down the hearings on these first two to get to the other one. Understood? And with that, I think we'll do just fine. On Senate Bill 1011, Sue, would you fill us in?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1011 authorizes counties and metropolitan service districts to create a process to designate rural reserves not included in urban growth boundaries or rural communities, modifies the process for designating urban reserves, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There is a -2 amendment that replaces the -1. It provides some technical language corrections and refinements and speaks to coordination with the county comprehensive plans.
And you know what else I am going to do is I'm opening up the hearing actually for 1011 and 2051 at the same time because some people are going to want to testify on both bills. Sue, do you want to do that one too?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2051A provides a one-time only extension from the 5-year to 7-year schedule for metropolitan service districts to complete an inventory determination and analysis of housing capacity and need within the urban growth boundary. Requires Metro to complete the first inventory determination and analysis due on or after December 1st, 2007, by December 31st, 2009. There is it's up to a -4 amendment, which would grant an exception for the city of Cornelius.
Okay, thank you. And we'll start with Lane Shetterly, Bob Rindy, and Jim Johnson. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I appreciate your accommodation. I've got another hearing down the hall, and I do understand that my being here first is something out of order. I know we have David Bragdon and Randy Tucker and others from Metro to give you the more technical and fuller presentation of the bills. Principally, I'm here to speak on House Bill 1011. Mr. Chair, just by way of background, this grew out of a cooperative effort involving the department, Metro, and the constituent jurisdictions of Metro, principally Washington County and among others, also involving the Department of Agriculture, which is why Jim Johnson is here. They were interested in, after their last experience, and you'll hear this directly from Councillor Bragdon and others, they were interested after their last go-around on the urban growth boundary amendment process in the metro area to see if there wasn't a different way to skin that cat. And so approached the department with a request for grant funds and assistance to engage their jurisdictions in an evaluation of how they do their growth boundary amendment. And we were happy to participate in the funding of that grant and were participants through the entire process, colloquially described as their ag-urban study and their great communities. at the end of that study and effort, really what you see before you in Senate Bill 1011 is the culmination of that, at least the first iteration of the culmination of that, to authorize rulemaking to create and designate rural reserves and rural preserves and urban reserves. Again, from the testimony that you'll hear, you'll get a better sense of how those are intended to work. Briefly, my place before you today is just to indicate that the Land Conservation and Development Commission has received a briefing from Metro and others involved in this, and without looking, of course, they did not have the benefit of the language of the bill, but certainly expressed their support for the concept that is embodied in the bill. Randy Tucker will tell you, I think, that they're working on language. We had some concerns about the timing of the rulemaking process, and of course our sense is that there's a hydraulic, that the more directive the bill can be in terms of how the rulemaking is to look or what the criteria should be, clearly the faster our commission will be able to get those rules out, and the less directive the legislature chooses to be, well, the more there will be then left to rulemaking. But in terms of concept and approach, we're interested in this as a laboratory exercise. We think it has some salutary benefits that could be put to good use by Metro in its next exercise in the boundary expansion, which of course touches on the other bill. We do understand that part and parcel of this, there's a synergy here between the Senate Bill 1011 and the other to extend the timeline so that the process can be built and then the urban growth boundary expansion can occur within the time frame. I understand the chair had some question about this bill in terms of, and I've heard it before, in terms of the big look and what's coming out of that. I think there's good reason to go ahead and move with this bill. In part, there's a timeliness element of this. Again, even with a two-year extension, Metro has a fairly short time frame to be about their next urban growth boundary expansion. These two bills together work well in providing the timing for that to occur. Also, frankly, in terms of I mentioned this as a laboratory experiment, as something that this bill authorizes for Metro. I think it could provide an opportunity for the Big Look to evaluate maybe a different way of how we undertake urban growth boundary expansions, amendments, and while preserving the best farmland, and things that the Big Look could actually avail themselves of, perhaps for statewide application based on how it goes forward in Metro. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are my brief comments. We do understand that Randy Tucker is working on some language relative to the perhaps narrowing the focus for the rulemaking and being a little bit more directive in the bill. We're supportive of that. But in terms of concept, we think this bill merits your most serious consideration.
Since I know you need to leave, let me see if the committee's got any questions for you first. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Director, can you highlight for me what is currently broke with the UGB system that we're fixing with this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I think the Metro experience will probably best be told to you by David Bragdon, and I don't know that broke is necessarily the word. I would say we can always improve on process, and I think what Metro can tell you is that they have been through the exercise enough times that their exception lands and basically the low-hanging fruit on the fringe of their urban growth boundary has pretty well been picked over in the years that they have been doing boundary expansions in Metro, and I think they're finding that each one is qualitatively more difficult to do by virtue of that. And that strictly applied, the hierarchy becomes less and less a guide, particularly in Metro where they've done the boundary expansions more frequently over the years than most cities have. And so this provides a different way to look at appropriate expansion areas outside of the strict application of the hierarchy of lands. I don't want to accept necessarily the premise that it's broken. I think in Metro's case, particularly because of their experience and having done it as many times as they have, they could benefit from a new way to look at those expansion areas besides and apart from the strict and literal application of the hierarchy of lands.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Appreciate you being here
today.
Well,
I appreciate your accommodation, Mr. Chair. I'll run down to hearing room E and see if they're still waiting for me.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Welcome.
Chair of ARCA and committee members, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I didn't want to explain a lot of details. I figured that the Metro staff would be up here and do that first, so I'll try to not do that, but some of the things I want to talk about relate to some very specific things in the bill. Overall, the department is very supportive of the concept of creating rural reserves as a match, so to speak, of urban reserves. Currently, under state law, there are no provisions. There's no such animal as a rural reserve that adds a layer of protection for agricultural land. So obviously, this is something that we're very interested in. There are some very strategic agricultural lands in the Portland metro area that are in direct line of development that merit some real consideration of such protection. The problem is in the details in this bill as far as we're concerned, and there's really not a very good clear connections yet, and there's a lot of drafts floating around in different angles on it, so I don't even know which one to really talk at, but there's really not a good enough connection in our view between what you have to do to qualify for an urban reserve versus then what kind of rural reserves you have to do to qualify to go into that other angle to create these new urban reserves that would be expanded on by the bill. And what I mean by that, there's a definition in the proposed bill that basically will allow you to do urban reserves built based on what are called sustainable and sustainable communities. What does that mean? We don't know. There's not a lot of definition in the bill in terms of what that is, and the details could be something that we might be concerned about. The another issue that we're very concerned about is, as the bill is drafted, rural reserves, once designated, would be placed in the hierarchy of lands in terms of the order of lands that could be placed inside urban growth boundaries. They would be placed last in the hierarchy, but the problem is the hierarchy has provisions built into state law that allow you to take exceptions and move anything within that hierarchy to the top. So unless that's constructed carefully, rural reserves may not add any further protection to agricultural lands than are currently provided under state law. Overall, we're a little bit concerned that there's too little direction and too less definition of some of the terms, and we'd like to see some of that fleshed out a little bit better, especially again as it relates to definitions of what an urban reserve and what a rural reserve are. And I just would like to throw in, Senator Atkinson asked what's broken. We don't believe anything is really broken here. The process has worked. It may have been too focused in some cases for some people or too controversial. I would suggest to you that that's the nature of what we're dealing with here. However, this would give us some new tools to do some better things and do a much more effective urban and rural planning on both sides of the urban growth boundary.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. I don't think the committee has any questions. David Bragdon, Michael Jordan, and Randy Tucker. Afternoon.
Afternoon.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you, Chair Vaca and members of the committee. We appreciate the chance to be here today and to address both these bills. Both these bills are connected to each other inextricably, and so we appreciate the chance to look at them as a piece. Being here in a crowded hearing room, I think, reminds all of us of times that we've been in hearing rooms in the past, and there are no hearing rooms more heated often than those that address urban growth boundary expansions. Our council's been through several of those episodes over the last several years that have led us here in the name of reforming the system. We had one particularly memorable hearing with 600 people in Wilsonville that many of us will remember. What concluded with the process across the board, regardless of ideology or geographic position in the region, with a lot of unhappiness with regard to the process itself, as well as, in some cases, the outcomes. What we have here today actually is the inverse of that. We have a broad coalition that's in support of some incremental reforms, or at least the chance for some reforms. And we've worked very hard in the interim period since our last urban growth boundary with the local governments and the interests in our region to try to construct a means for us to develop some common sense reforms. Senator Atkinson asked about what's broken with the current system. Unlike Mr. Johnson, with all respect to Mr. Johnson, Mr. Shetterly, I think our council and many of the participants in our region would say that the current urban growth boundary system actually is broken. Not all of the things that we would consider broken are addressed by these two bills. These two bills are an incremental step to give us the chance to try to address some of the things that are broken. Questions such as how infrastructure is financed in new areas, questions of how and where choices are made and the frequency with which choices are made, and the chance for some stability for property owners in other areas as well and for our neighboring jurisdictions. Over the last two or three years since our last expansion of the urban growth boundary, we have worked with the other jurisdictions and has developed this coalition that's going to be talking with you today. And the question has been raised, do some of these incremental changes here preempt the big look? And I want to address that as a member of that panel. In fact, I think these incremental reforms for our part of the state actually will help the big look's work rather than preempt it, and I'll get to that in a second. The elements of these bills, the 2051 is a one-time timeout from the treadmill that we're otherwise on in terms of expansion of the urban growth boundary. And we're currently under the state law where every 5 years we do that. Unless this law has changed, we would embark on that again later on this year. And again, with all due respect to Mr. Shetterly, we have yet to receive the final order from our last urban growth boundary expansion. So we'd be beginning the work on that five-year cycle without benefit of the final approval of the last one that we did. This, in a sense, is really where our work does. These bills would do the opposite of preempting the big look. Were we to stay on the schedule that's in the current state law, we would be expanding the urban growth boundary under the existing regime in 2008 before the Big Look reports in, and I would predict that the Big Look is going to suggest overhauls to the urban growth boundary system as a whole. So, in fact, this timeout gives the Big Look the chance to propose those reforms rather than having us embark on that and then run smack dab into them prior to 2009. The other bill in front of you today with regard to urban and rural reserves provides part of what we asked the permission to be working on in the meantime. It's not that we're asking for a timeout so that we can go to the beach or do other things. We're asking for a timeout so that we can focus on these reforms and making better the ability to make better decisions when we do make them down the line. As Mr. Johnson, Mr. Shetterly said, a lot of the work on this actually has been done already by the Oregon Department of Agriculture and by the county governments and neighboring jurisdictions in our region in terms of identifying some of the factors with regard to agriculture and with regard to urbanization that ought to be taken into account in designating urban and rural reserves, factors that are not part of the current regime that we think do need to be resolved. And by working with the county governments in our region as well as Department of Agriculture and LCDC, we have a good start on this type of work, so it wouldn't be starting from scratch were you to approve this bill. It actually provides stability for both sides of the equation in terms of urbanization and in terms of stability for the agricultural industry, and allows some discretion other than the soil types that are part of the system that we have inherited. I think you'll hear today that there's broad support because of the work that we've done over the past 2 years with the neighboring jurisdictions, particularly on this issue, the county governments, and I think you'll hear from them that there's broad support. This was unanimously approved by our policy advisory committee, which consists of county commissioners and mayors from throughout the region, and it's an unusual fact that something would be unanimously approved by that diverse a body. So we ask for your approval of these bills. Again, if no action is taken, what we have to do then is abide by the current system, which means embark on expanding the urban growth boundary under a system that we think has not worked very well because it doesn't provide predictability or flexibility, and that it doesn't address the various factors of urbanization and protection of the agricultural industry. So we hope that you will support these bills and allow our council as well as the communities that we represent and the people that we represent to use that time productively to come up with a better system. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I would like to just dive a little bit into the mechanics of both what we've handed you today.
Do that, but I'd like you to do it as quickly as you possibly can because we've still got about 30 other people signed up to testify.
That's fine. Mr. Chair, as you know, I'm in the Capitol virtually every day, so why don't I just talk about the process around the bill itself, or Senate Bill 1011, or both bills just very briefly, and I'll skip the materials here. Senate Bill 2051, as you know from the sheet on the front right of your packets, at the very bottom, passed the House 55-2 a few weeks ago, it has broad support, as you can see from the next sheet, from a variety of different constituencies that are concerned with Metro's UGB process. The bill is a paragraph and a half or long or so, and we believe the bill is ready to go at your convenience. I don't really have to get into the substance there. I think President Bragdon has explained what it does. The one-time, two-year extension of our urban growth boundary evaluation cycle. Senate Bill 1011 is a different story altogether. You have some -2 amendments, and I would just urge you not to take too much time engrossing them into your bill, because there will be more amendments. I'm quite certain. We just received these amendments about an hour ago, and so I have not had a chance to dig through them. The process of creating the bill has involved, in terms of the drafting, primarily the three counties, Portland, and Metro, and then a couple of other parties have been around the table to get the initial drafts going. And in the last several weeks, there's been more attention paid to the bill by members of the broader regional community, from the business side, from the agricultural side, et cetera. There are some ongoing meetings that we hope will get this thing dialed in the next week or so that we can bring a finished product to you. The two things I'd like to note very briefly. Mr. Chair, you've heard a couple of comments already about the need for a little bit greater specificity in the bill, and those conversations are in fact underway. We've got some language we're starting to fiddle with and share that we think will get us to the point that both Mr. Shetterly and Mr. Johnson have mentioned. I think you'll hear as well from other participants. I just wanted to draw your attention to the back of this one pager, the Senate Bill 1011 one that's on the front left of your packet, the first two sections, just a very brief description of the ag urban study that has led to the drafting of this bill. And then the second section there is about the briefest summary I think you can have of the bill itself. So I'll just leave you with that and be happy to try to answer any questions. Certainly, if you have more specific questions, in addition to myself, we've got Dick Benner sitting in the second row here, who is the primary scribe that has actually written down words on paper, obviously sitting at the table with everyone else. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good. Mr. Jordan?
I'll allow her to take my time, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I'll let the folks go. Thanks very much. Committee, any questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Next up, Kelly Ross, Harlan Levy, and Beverly Bookin. And for everybody else who will come up to testify on the next two bills, I let these first couple panels go a little bit longer than the other folks will be allowed to go, only because it's either their bill or they're going to be in charge of agencies implementing it if it were to pass. Everybody else, keep your testimony down to about a minute and a half to 2 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Ross. I represent the Oregon chapter of NAOP, which is the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties. Very briefly, echo what your previous witnesses have said. It would be a very good thing to improve the UGB management tools, but it wouldn't be a very good thing to add more distraction or vague terms, conflicting provisions to the law, and we would just like to work some more on making sure that's not the case.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. First wanted to say that we do support House Bill 2051. We worked with Metro on getting amendments to that bill on the House side and do support that bill as it's currently before you. With respect to Senate Bill 1011, we do support the idea of simplifying the urban reserve designation process. That would be a huge benefit, we think, to the state, to the Portland area as well. But we are concerned about the rural reserves aspect of the bill. Now, what that would end up doing is basically creating another category of land that goes beyond the existing priority land statute that would, for all intents and purposes, be off limits for a UGB expansion. However, we do realize that, you know, in this process there are political trade-offs that get made, so we could end up supporting the entire package, the entire bill, if the urban reserve process, designation process was simultaneous with the rural reserve designation process, and we have heard that there are amendments coming forward that would do that. But also, if there was explicit language in the statute that said that the designation of urban reserves would be based on urban factors rather than on the priority land statute. We see that as a huge problem with the current system. The priority land statute was basically just a look at soil types, whereas a balancing test based on urban needs and urban factors for designation of urban reserves, we think, would make this bill a good bill and a bill that we could support. With that, I'd be happy to conclude my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Levy. Ms. Bookin, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Beverly Bookin, and for the record, I am here on behalf of the Commercial Real Estate Economic Coalition, which is an organization of 12 trade associations, organizations, and companies involved in development, management, and operation of commercial real estate. Again, we also would like to mirror what we have heard from my two colleagues here about our interest in these two bills, which we believe are joined at the hip, and we would not be in favor of a two-year extension unless we improve the way in which we do the regional UGB decision in the Portland metropolitan area. The last time round was contentious, difficult, and unsatisfactory for all parties. We particularly support efforts to revitalize the urban reserve process, which is already memorialized in statute and Oregon rules, but to replace the way in which that is done by replacing the agricultural land hierarchy with urban factors that are about the nature and characteristic of urban development. We believe that the process needs to be more balanced so that urban and rural considerations can be considered simultaneously and using factors that are appropriate for both. There are some aspects of this bill that we don't agree with, others that we think need more work. We have been one of the many organizations working with Metro in the last month to improve those provisions and continue and wish to continue to do so. However, in order to do that, to continue this excellent conversation, we do need to see the bill move forward into the committee process, and we urge you to move it on through. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony very much. Stephen Cafori, Ed Bartlemy, and Mary Kyle McCurdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here today representing the South Cooper Mountain Landowners Association. You're hearing some technical testimony and some conceptual testimony. We want to bring a real face to this and show you what exactly would happen on the ground with an urban reserve designation. I have Ed Bartlemy here, who's the head of the Landowners Association, and he has a map he's passing out talking to you about our area that we hope to bring in to be designated as an urban reserve and why, and I'll let him talk.
Hi, Mr. Chair. Ed Bartholomew, South Cooper Mountain Landowners. We think that urban reserves make a lot of sense so that we can do some planning before it comes in the urban growth boundary to make more educated decision on how which areas should come in, and instead of just continually picking at the edges without really master planning the entire area. Our main concern is that it's written so that it really works, and I know that you got a tight time schedule, so I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, just let me briefly say, you'll notice in the map here we have about 1,400 acres of land What we plan to do with this is not bring the whole thing into the UGB or ask to have it brought in at one time. It will be brought in only as the individual areas demonstrate a need for them. But if we plan the whole thing ahead of time, then we can say, here's where the high-density housing should be, here's where the commercial should be, here's where the road should be. And then as smaller parcels are brought into the UGB, it would be part of an entire plan rather than having it not fit when it comes in. And that's the purpose of the urban reserves, and that's why we're supporting the bill. Conceptually, we're, again, looking to see what the amendments look like.
Good afternoon, Chair Avakian and committee members. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1000 Friends of Oregon. We support the concept of urban reserves and rural reserves if done properly on both counts. Everyone involved recognizes that we are charting new waters here, and there are tremendous trade-offs involved and a lot of trust that has to be generated about this process. However, we can also work within the current system of urban growth boundary evaluations and expansions. That is, we don't think the current system is broken, but it can be improved. And the urban reserve, rural reserve concept offers a method to meet the needs and concerns of many. But we don't think the system's broken simply because it generates controversy and difficult decisions and public participation. We think that's a success. It shows people care about where they live. To us, the broken part of the process is a five-year cycle that Metro's on, addressing Senate Bill 2051 first. That cycle creates instability because it is very fast. We support the extension in 2051, regardless of the outcome of 1011. In 1011, authorizing urban and rural reserves, we will want to see our concerns met, which are three. Certainty of protection for agricultural lands, including criteria for how to designate those lands based on work that's already been done by the Department of Agriculture. Longevity of protection for those lands as rural reserves, so that, one, the agricultural industry can make the same sort of long-term investments in their industry that all industries need to make. And two, that the system has institutional stability. That is, it's not dependent on the individuals who make up any governmental body at any given time, whether that's Metro or a county commission. And finally, a process that is inclusive. We've just started having discussions with Metro and other interested parties about this bill. We've recommended some changes to meet our concerns, and we'll be continuing to meet, and we hope that we can reach consensus. In the interest of time, I won't go into the details of those. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, three of you. John Chandler, Jim McCauley, Don Schellenberg.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll start, they said. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. What's the real purpose for a rural reserve? What does that mean? Long-term protection. I assume that's what the purpose of the rural reserve is. Another question, what is the purpose of the EFU zone? Long-term protection. What's the difference between a rural reserve and EFU zone? I don't know. I don't see the difference in that regard. Long-term protection is the goal of both. What we have here is we suffer from a problem of what the land use planning system is believed to do and what it actually does. What most people believe the land use planning system does is protect agricultural land long-term. What does it do? It's not drafted that way, no. What it does is provide for to eventually pave over the whole state. We're just going to do it in an orderly fashion. So how do we get around that problem? And I think that's where Metro's heart probably is in the right place. We're just not sure that this is the right way to do it. We think that the problem with the part of the problem with the bill, there's not quite enough direction in establishing where the urban reserves are and where the rural reserves are and how you make that decision. It could be done so that the urban reserves are around the metro boundary while the rural reserves kind of encase satellite cities, which doesn't provide a whole lot of protection for a lot of farmland, but it does for some farmland in some areas. So current expansion, UGB current expansion system that's talked about having some problems, we do believe it does have some problems. We still support the hierarchy. The problem that Mr. Johnson indicated is there's a loophole there that you can get around a lot of those things and bring in any piece of land that you like by going through that loophole. We think there needs to be changes, and we've addressed those in House Bill 3462, which you don't have in front of you, but is over on the House side. But we recognize that there are problems with the UGB expansion thing as well. We do support House Bill 2051 and would urge your support of that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair Avakian, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim McCauley, representing Portland Metro Homebuilder Association. Just brief comments. Our members want to, of course, try to get the yes on this bill, Senate Bill 1011, and we're hopeful with the process that we've had a chance to engage in the last couple of weeks, as well as this week, and what we'll be doing until the end of the month, is trying to come to a position where everybody can try to agree on the various amendments that are out there that are going to hopefully introduce enough clarity and directional needs on this bill to make sure that we have a system that is an alternative to what we currently have for the Portland metro area, and hopefully provide us with a much better system for expanding UGB. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Homebuilders Association. In the interest of time, I will not engage in tomato-tomato with Mr. Schellenberg, but I think I can speak for both of us with our willingness to come back and do that any time at the committee's discretion. With regard to both House Bill 2051 and Senate Bill 1011, from the homebuilder standpoint, they're both efforts at solving, getting a solution to a very difficult issue, the balance between ag land protection and urban growth management. We think, and I'd like to commend Metro for a good effort in both cases, I think, trying to get their head around a very controversial and complicated matter. I don't think there's any conflict with the Big Look. In fact, I think what's happening here is, for one thing, a level of detail that the Big Look is likely not to get to, and secondly, that the effort that we're undertaking with both these bills is complementary to the direction the Big Look is going to be taking. We don't know if we're going to get there yes yet. We believe we will. I think Metro's got a good group together to look at them. We are committed to working in that process, try to bring forward amendments that we can recommend to this committee and getting the bill moving.
Good. Thank you very much. Pat Rebellia, Jack Isselman. We're going to spend about 10 more minutes on these two bills before moving on to Senate Bill 235. If folks are brief in their testimony, we may get through most of the folks that are signed up on these. Appreciate that.
Senator Chair Avakian and committee members, Pat Rebellia, project manager for the city of Hillsborough. We have submitted some written testimony on behalf of the mayor who had scheduled conflicts. In the interest of time, I would just summarize that we do support the passage of 1011 as probably will be amended, and as well as House Bill 2051. They're connected, and we hope that both will move through the session.
Very good.
Thank you.
Mr. Isselman.
Nothing to add, Chair Biden. Thank you.
Gold star for Mr. Isselman. Good work. Brent Curtis, Scott Lazenby, and Mike Stewart.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Brent Curtis. I'm the planning manager for Washington County. And I'm here on behalf of the county, the board in particular. We have a short letter that we're presenting you that's under the signature of Chair Bryan. Washington County has worked for approximately 3 years now on examining these issues, and you've heard a lot about the history of that. For us, it began when we understood that there was widespread unease, perhaps even dissatisfaction with the UGB process as it played out in Washington County's community. And we convened people from both sides of the line, the urban community and the agricultural community, to see if that was really true and to see if they wanted to work towards improvements to the process. And that, in fact, turned into what Lane Shetterly described to you, an investment by the state in allowing us to do further work, and then ultimately the regionalization of the process by including Metro, the managers of and the keepers of the UGB and the various communities in the Portland region that have worked on this bill. Very quickly, we support 2051 and 1011 and are committed to continuing to address the valid concerns that people have about the clarity of the bill and adding additional information to address concerns. And we would hope very much that we could return shortly to the committee with amendments that would accomplish those things.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Scott Lazenby, the city manager for the city of Sandy. We are one of the few cities in the state that has an adopted urban reserve. It's been a very helpful planning tool for us. But specifically, I'm here today to support 1011. We see that the rural reserve as a potential tool to help preserve the separation or the separate community identity of our city in Sandy is separate from the larger metro area.
Chair Avakian, other panel members. I'm Mike Stewart. I live on Johnson Road in Clackamas County, Westland. And as much as I understand metro's challenges, I'm here to oppose 2051. The fallout from constricting the land in the metro area is we are seeing an unanticipated escalation of prices of land, and that is forcing families out of their home sites. We're seeing closures of mobile home parks. We're seeing conversions of apartments into condominiums, and these people are least likely to be able to defend themselves. I brought for you copies of articles out of the local papers in Portland, and I'm not going to read them. I think if we do not add some lands that are adjacent to major infrastructure, we're going to continue to see this problem. Damascus, when it was brought in, it isn't approved yet. It isn't finished. It took in more land at the final decision than was originally anticipated. And it's going to take about 20 years to make it usable land. And there are parcels of land, there are sections of land in the Metro UGB that can be brought in that are adjacent to major thoroughfares with reasonable access to essential services, and people want to live in those areas, and that will take pressure off of a number of these apartments and mobile home parks. Thank you for your time.
Okay, very good. Thank you, the three of you. And we have one more panel on this bill, and that will be Kevin Curry, Jonathan Schluter, and Carol Cheserek. Senator George, I see you in the back. The bill you're going to testify on is up right after this panel.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Curry, and I'm testifying today with my partner, Devin Lyon, and we represent the Portland Metropolitan Association of Realtors, or PMAR for short. PMAR represents nearly 8,000 real estate professionals in the Portland metropolitan area. We support Senate Bill 1011 because we believe the bill, in its final form, will help bring certainty and longer-term stability to the residential real estate market, as well as additional predictability for public investment in critical infrastructure projects. PMAR believes that the current process involved in expanding the urban growth boundary takes too long, is too ambiguous, and is replete with uncertainties. This bill, although not perfect in its current form, is light years ahead of the process in terms of an orderly, predictable approach to urban growth. PMAR has been actively involved in the work group that is refining the bill and will continue to participate in order to bring forward an amendment that is supported by stakeholders. As has been said earlier in the testimony, it is the stated goal of the work group to have an amendment that this committee will be able to move before the April deadline. We're encouraged by the dedication and hard work of this incredibly diverse group of interested parties and what they have undertaken to make growth of Portland region as fair, orderly, and predictable as possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Schluter. I'm the executive director of Westside Economic Alliance. We represent a number of the employers, the developers, the commercial property managers, and the communities in your district in Washington County and on the west side of the Portland metro region. One of the handouts that I've provided to the committee here offers some of the talking points that we boast about the economic growth and development of the west side, noting that our population is now at a record high of over 500,000 people. We have an all-time record number of people working at an all-time record record number of jobs. We also are earning more money than we ever have before. All of these are good boasting points and good talking points, but the message to this committee, regardless of what part of the state you represent, is that Washington County accounts for one of six personal income tax dollars moving here to Salem. Depending on your interests and priorities in this legislative session for K-12 education, public education, health care access, the rainy day fund, state cops on the highways, realize that one of six income tax dollars used to pay for it all is originating with a job and a payroll from Washington County. We need to keep that economic growth and that engine moving, literally and figuratively, and I'm here to tell you that we don't have the industrial land needs that we are going to need to meet our 20-year land supply. Metro is required to provide a 20-year supply of land. I'm here to tell you that we are out of that industrial land. The sheets that we've provided to you here show only three shovel-ready sites in Washington County. One of those outside the urban growth boundary is currently defined. That is a serious concern. House Bill 2051 provides for a residential lands needs analysis this year before the two-year extension to the urban growth boundary consideration is offered. It speaks nothing to the industrial lands needs of the Portland metro region. Our concern, therefore, with House Bill 2051 as currently amended is that it does not give any consideration to the industrial lands needs of the Portland metro region. I am encouraged by the discussion here of the Senate Bill 1011. We were more interested in this bill when we were talking about agricultural reserves than rural reserves. The waters got muddied in a hurry when we broadened the net to include natural spaces and undefined natural features that do not contribute to the economy and are not economic based. To preserve the farming sector and to allow farmers and their bankers to invest and expand in their operations made a great deal of sense. We're not sure what the term rural reserves are. We need more clarity on that. I find comfort in Lane Shetterly's comments that this bill does not apparently conflict with Goal 14 or the Big Look Task Force, because those are questions that our group certainly have about this bill. We see that this sets a new language and new criteria that is in conflict with Goal 14. I would like very much to hear from the project management team on this bill as to how they are going to address that, specific to the Tri-County region, specific to the Portland metro region, without conflicting with the state planning goal of Goal 14 and the urbanization of the greater state of Oregon. And, I guess I'll leave it at that in the interest of your time. Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate your testimony very much. Ms. Cheserek.
Carol Cheserek. I live in Forest Park neighborhood, and I'm here today to express Forest Park Neighborhood Association's strong support for Senate Bill 1011. Our neighborhood strongly favors protecting the regional natural resources that exist in our area, and we believe that Forest Park is a unique resource that is a very important economic asset, and that natural resources in the state of Oregon for recreation and other purposes are important to the economy of the state and attracting businesses to the state. And we'd like to work with Metro to protect Forest Park and the areas adjacent to the park. We're tired of fighting UGB expansion battles every 5 years. We have to get out because we're right on that edge. It's very time-consuming, and it's difficult. So participation and controversy may be good, but it gets tiring. Today's land use rules don't adequately protect significant natural resources or agricultural land from urbanization. We need a new tool like rural reserves so that these lands aren't eaten away in small bites to the point that they're no longer viable for either farmland or wildlife habitat. Among the other problems, we see a lot of speculation driving up land prices around the edge of the boundary so that farmers can no longer afford to buy that land and farm on it. The current system of UGB expansions every 5 years doesn't promote efficient planning or development of infrastructure, which raises the cost of new development. This is really clear as I've been following the North Bethany process. They have to look all around that area. Where are we going to grow? We don't know. Well, what infrastructure do we have to build? It's very hard to make logical decisions for efficient use of infrastructure, and we don't have a lot of money to waste on infrastructure anymore. So our neighborhood feels that this bill balances the needs of agriculture, urban areas, and natural resources areas, and we encourage you to move it forward. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much to the three of you, and thanks to everybody who testified as concisely as you did. We were able to get through that and appreciated your helpful testimony. I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2051 and 1011. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235, And Senator George, we will begin with you if you want to make your way up to the table.
Chime in?
Sue, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 235 allows the Environmental Quality Commission and the State Department of Agriculture to provide for department administration and enforcement of air quality laws applicable to agricultural operations or equipment. It expands the duties and powers of the State Department of Agriculture's Natural Resource Division. There is a Dash 1 amendment that would require rather than allow the Environmental Quality Commission and the Department of Agriculture to enter into memorandum of understanding. It also includes a timeline and for rulemaking necessary to implement the Federal Clean Air Act.
Thank you. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nice to have you here.
I thought I've moved bills in the past in my committees, but you are going to take the degree for the day on the way you move this one. And thank you very much for accepting my testimony. For the record, my name is State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. And to give you an idea what District 12 is, it is basically the farm ground between Gaston and Monroe, almost all the way down to Eugene. So it's a large district made up mainly of farmers. That will bring me to the next subject, which is my background. Of course, I am a farmer. Both of my grandfathers were dairymen. And I'm going to speak to you right now about one issue, and that is the mega dairies that have come into the valley. They've occupied most of the dairy country of Central California, and we're here today. And so I would like to at this time show you front page headlines of local newspaper. DEQ reports details of chemicals in Newburgh Pool, stretch of the Willamette River between Salem and Newburgh, included in a list of water quality limited sites with significant pollution. Now, as you just heard, we have a major problem with 1 million people going to come into this valley, particularly between this area of Salem and Portland. Now, what that means is we're all going to have to be just a little bit more careful on how we handle the environment, because obviously our river is about at capacity. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is a couple of issues that I've personally experienced, and I would just like to say at this time that I'm going to rewrite the scripture after today, and it's going to say, blessed are the peacemakers, because they will have bruises on both sides of their face, because I'm right in the middle of this one. Trust me.
I thought they inherited the earth.
That's correct. What we have today, of course, are extremely large confinement livestock operations that have entered into our state and basically everywhere. And it's a function, basically, of economics. I mean, every farmer's had to grow in order to survive. But part of that problem has been, and going back to the old days in college and animal husbandry classes, is that the more you confine and the greater the number, the worse the problem of handling the waste, in other words, what you have received from that livestock base. And, of course, what we have to worry about here in the Willamette Valley is we also have an enormous population of geese, which, by the way, yields the fecal coliform of about 6 million head of livestock. So you put the combination of the massive geese population we have with increasing livestock, with increasing pollution, from city dwellers, and you have a situation which you say we better be monitoring all aspects of the environment. Now, we have a situation, it's out in Polk County, and you see my colleague right here alongside of me. I hope we're on the same side, but if not, you're going to hear both sides of the story now. And that is, As the size of these operations has increased, you have a situation which obviously you have to deal with the manure problem. I ran back during the break and I tried to find some research that I recently witnessed on a TV program talking about, I believe it was a professor from Wisconsin. I couldn't find it and I'm sorry I couldn't do that. And basically what it is, they have been able to solve the problem of the tremendous odor that is emitted from a confinement livestock operation. And I was so encouraged by that, and I hit my PVR and recorded it only the next day to be going through and scrolling through and eliminating and deleted that program. But I will find that for the committee as you get back further into the bill. Now, the reason for that is that technology is taking us to the place where, in fact, in a few years, we will probably be able to deal with, the odor and with, the ammonia problems that you'll find in confinement operations. But my concern with this bill is that we must make sure that we maintain a level of scrutiny that will ensure that the public health of everyone who's surrounding our agricultural operations is considered, that we don't have additional problems occurring with the tributaries and the rivers of the state of Oregon. I don't have my sticker that says I support the Dash 1 amendments to the bill, but I have a lot of people here that are going to talk about it, and that's what I hope I can convince you to do, is to approach this on the basis of all the problems I've just discussed, and hopefully be able to realize that we need to do something to make sure that we do not have any further degradation of the environment of Western Oregon. The potential is here for us to take the most beautiful place in the world and turn it into something completely different than that. Public health is critical. Health of our rivers is critical. I believe we'll have the technology in a few years, but that's going to take scrutiny from agency, from the Department of Agriculture and DEQ. Part of the thing I do appreciate about the bill was the idea of approaching this on the basis of education, working with the person that has an environmental problem in their farming operations, working with them to solve that problem. Those of us, and I have another fellow farmer on your committee, and I can tell you that that's how we function. We have to adapt constantly in this business. So when you give us a new set of parameters and requirements, and particularly with a university system that can give us the research we need, and or if we can borrow it from Wisconsin, then we'll be able to solve these problems. But it will take that kind of scrutiny to make sure that as we begin to solve the problems, that we don't damage the environment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Why don't we go to Representative Boquist before we do that? I didn't see you in the room when I called the senator up. Sorry about that, Representative. Glad you're here.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, I'm State Representative Brian Boquist. I represent the 23rd House District, which is 5 rural counties of Western Oregon. And like my good colleague to the right here, I too was quite familiar with the farming industry, not only having farm, but was born and raised shoveling manure on a dairy farm in Tillamook. And so I'm quite familiar with this. I'm actually here today, Mr. Chair, because I've been contacted by dozens of constituents who have expressed great concern on the emission standards and the emissions from industrial scale operations that have moved in. And I digress a little bit from the testimony there. I mean, I grew up in Tillamook, where TCCA, Tillamook County Creamery Association, was the dairy association there. And when I went to school, there were 200-some farms down there. And due to economics and everything else, I think it's less than 75 now that have been merged together, because larger sometimes apparently is better when you're, especially in Tillamook, when trying to comply with federal regulations. So, having come from that area, I understand the concerns that they have in that concentration. I've actually heard from several neighbors in the area that I live about the emission standards of operations there, examples of the lagoon, the smell of the lagoon carrying over drainage into their areas, and some of them complaining of becoming sick. One of my constituents recently did sell his home in that area, a home some 40 years, taking a rather significant loss because simply buyers didn't want to move back into the area. Like the senator here, and I'm not sure exactly where he stands, and I'm not an expert. You're going to hear the experts here later. I have come here to ask you to look at the Dash 1 amendment. One of the things I believe is that Oregon agriculture should be able to continue to flourish in the state. However, we need to ensure that the health, the quality of life, the property values of our rural residents and our city residents remain high to the Oregon standards we've expected. Passing SB 235 without the Dash amendments, at least in my opinion, would tie the state's hands and prevent them from addressing some of the emission problems, the hydrogen sulfide issues, and ammonia that comes out from some of these industrial properties. And like the senator, I mean, I believe there's much greater expertise behind us. I have shoveled a lot of this stuff in my life, and this is an issue. As I say, I've had dozens of constituents, both sides, contact me. And so no matter how we come out of this, this may be one of those pieces of legislation that's typical. Not everybody's going to be happy, but everybody's going to get something.
Committee, any questions for your colleagues? Seeing none, thank you both much for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go back and work on the Kruger issue now.
I don't think that helped your chances much, Representative Boquist. Kendra Kambrowski, Jeanette Logan, and Aaron Miller. No, yeah. I've got their names here.
By all means.
Good
Go ahead. You can state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Erin Miller. I'm here with League of Women Voters of Oregon. Should I wait for Chair Vaughn?
No, go ahead, please.
Okay. The League just wants to let everybody know that we believe that the Dash 1 amendments to SB 235 address gaps in the original bill, which did not specify sources, pollutants, or protected areas affected by agricultural air pollution. The most significant of the proposed amendments are the ones addressing emissions to protect the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area and the reduction of hydrogen sulfide and ammonia emissions from agricultural businesses, such as concentrated animal feeding operations. We also believe that the proposed amendments, if properly interpreted and adhered to by rulemaking agencies, will greatly enhance Oregon's ability to positively affect our region's air quality. The League would prefer that the responsibility for enforcement lie directly with a single agency rather than established through memoranda of understanding. We also believe that the state of Oregon should have the option of setting higher emission standards than federal requirements. With the addition of the Dash 1 amendments, the League supports SB 235. We urge your support and thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
Chair Vakian and members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Kendra Kimbaraskis, and I'm co-president of an organization called Friends of Family Farmers. We are an all-volunteer citizens group working to promote socially responsible agriculture in Oregon. Through education and advocacy, we promote family farming, healthy and sustainable rural communities, and citizens having a voice in the siting and construction of industrial factory farms that have the potential to impact rural communities, public health, and the environment. Friends of Family Farmers is just over a year old, and already we have over 100 supporters statewide, many of which are family farmers and rural residents that span the state from Pendleton to Ashland and throughout the Willamette Valley. On behalf of Friends of Family Farmers, I'm here to ask that you support the Senate Bill 235-1 amendment, because without the amendment, Senate Bill 235 does absolutely nothing to protect public health, a good quality of life, and property values from the negative impacts of emissions from industrial farms. I've been traveling the state talking to rural residents who have had an industrial farm move into their neighborhood and are impacted by the emissions. I'm unable to justly represent how these rural residents are individually impacted, so I'm just going to use their words. Allison and Jared Ogden, I own. We have a wonderful 3-year-old daughter, and we are working on more kids. When our daughter can't go outside to play because of the urine smell so strong you can't go outside, it affects our way of life. Fran and Bill Taylor, Malala. Our home is 1/8 mile from a large poultry farm, which produces 1.5 million birds annually and is just over a year old. Our deck and yard, which used to be a joy to us, are almost now unusable due to the overwhelming odor from the poultry operation. We are concerned about the pollutants adversely impacting our health and property values. Harold and Dorothy Stusand, Hermiston. At times the smell is so bad that I can't even be outside at my daughter's house in Irrigan. It causes my head to ache and plugs my sinuses. Christine Breedwell, Rick Rial. I can't even enjoy our gardens or open the windows. I'm afraid to have any special celebration like a wedding reception for the fear that that day would be the day that the dairy really sent its odors our way. LaDonna and Darvel King, Irrigan. We can't be outside when it stinks. We can hardly stand to feed our horses. We've had to cancel barbecues because of it, and it being the smell. Steve Sawyer, Hermiston. I make my living in an agricultural business as an irrigation pipe welder. What would you have me do? Moving is not an option. I have no desire to move, and I shouldn't have to move. What would you have me do? Ralph and Ann Mortar, I own. We are not in favor of micromanaging air quality to the point where all of us would be forbidden to make dust. However, it seems logical that the state regulatory agencies need to be able to police huge operations that are using an agricultural exemption to their advantage. Paul Small of Rick Rial. In 2001, after my health deteriorated and the quality of life that I valued in Rick Rial was ruined, my wife Nancy and I decided that it was time to sell our home and move away from the smell of the dairy. Our house was appraised at $400,000 and put on the market with the Windmill Realtors. We had people from all over the West Coast look at our property and say they loved it, would be interested in purchasing it, but that they wouldn't be able to live with the smell of the dairy. It wasn't until we lowered the price by $100,000 and agreed to finance the sale ourselves were we able to find a buyer. Real people, many of which come from farming backgrounds, or are currently farming, are experiencing problems as a result of these emissions from large farms. Opponents to Senate Bill 235-1 amendment say that there's not enough science and that the concern with these industrial farms is simply smell. That is simply not true. Smell is indicative of other toxic gases such as hydrogen sulfide and ammonia that are known to be in concentrated animal waste. These gases threaten human health, and this is well documented and supported by peer-reviewed research, of which I have provided you in a sample with my testimony. Please support Senate Bill 235-1 Amendment to ensure that the health, quality of life, and property value of rural residents are protected. And the packet, just to give you just a quick oversight of what is in the packet, I've included this fact sheet, which basically has research from across the nation, peer-reviewed about what the emissions from industrial farms are doing to people. I've included a photo of the Three Mile Canyon Farm Complex out in Boardman, Oregon, so you can see that we are not talking about a family farm. I've included a picture of the Rick Riel Dairy Lagoon, which if you head up from Salem to the coast, you practically drive over it, and you may have smelled it at time. I've included a testimony from Paul Small, the fellow who Representative Boquist referenced in the sense of having to lose the having a huge financial loss because of the dairy. He actually is undergoing heart surgery today. Otherwise, he would be here to talk to you himself. He tried to get his doctor to push it back, but his doctor said no. So there's that. There's a petition from Rick Riel residents. And then the last piece are letters from across the state from people that have serious concerns with these dairies. Thank you very much.
Chair Avakian, members of the committee, good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Jeanette Logan, and I'm from Ione, Oregon. My husband and I have traveled here today because we are worried about the impact that industrial farms are having on our health, our property value, and the community in which we live. We are wheat farmers and have farmed in the Ione area for over 40 years. We continue to reside in eastern Oregon because of a love of the land and a quality of life that we have worked hard to achieve. Now we feel that this may be in jeopardy. Approximately 7 years ago, 6 miles from our home of 34 years, Three Mile Canyon Farms, Willow Creek Dairy, and Columbia River Dairy, which total over 55,000 cows, moved in. The Three Mile Canyon Farms complex's 55,000 cows release more than 5.6 million pounds of ammonia gas into our air each year. In addition, there are two open pit manure lagoons that are approximately 15 acres apiece, or the size of 10 football fields each, are the source of hydrogen sulfide, a gas that at certain levels can be deadly to those that are exposed. On a regular basis, noxious odors from the dairy and unsafe farming practices travel to our property and penetrate our home. Often the odor is so overpowering that I am forced to forfeit my daily walks or just sitting in my backyard because the air causes my eyes to burn. In the summer months, the stink is so unbearable that we can't open our windows at night, something we often enjoyed long before the dairies moved in. Yes, the stink from the dairies is noxious, but of more concern to neighbors and us is what impact these toxic gases are having on our health and our property values. We have been around agriculture all of our lives, and we know and understand the smells of the farm. However, due to the magnitude of these mega livestock operations and their potential to pollute the air we breathe, we do not feel that industrial-scale operations should be afforded the same protections as our traditional family-style farmers and ranchers in our state. We are here today to specifically ask that you adopt the SB 235-1 amendment. Those of us who live in rural communities need adequate protections in place that ensure that our health, our quality of life, and our property values are not negatively impacted by industrial farms. We want to make sure that we are protected by proper legislation and that our best interests are kept in mind as you consider these amendments. SB 235 by itself does nothing but fix on paper a technicality of the exemption for agriculture from Oregon's air rules. If only the exemption is removed, even Three Mile Canyon Farms with their 55,000 cows will not have to change any of their practices and will only result in business as usual as the continuing stench and influx of toxic gases violates my home and the homes of my neighbors. Eastern Oregon is becoming a depository for all that is unsafe and unhealthy. Adopting the SB 235-1 amendment is a small step that you can take to ensure that our quality of life is respected and we are taken care of. Factory farms should not be afforded the same protections as family farmers. It is time to withdraw the agricultural exemption and put a system in place that not only brings Oregon into compliance with law, but that empowers the state to enact adequate safeguards in order to protect rural residents, our rural communities, and the rural way of life. Please support SB 235-1. Thank you.
Thank you. Andy Ginsberg, Lisa Hansen. Welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Avakian, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator for the Department of Environmental Quality. And with me is Lisa Hansen, the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And we're here in support of Senate Bill 235, which would authorize our agencies to regulate air emissions from agriculture as required by the Clean Air Act. And I'd like to just rewind a little bit and go into just a little bit of the background of why this bill is necessary and what the bill does. We have in Oregon existing law exempts agriculture from air quality regulation, and that's been the case for many, many years, with one exception, which is field burning in the Willamette Valley. However, there is no comparable exemption in the federal law. And because of the larger operations that you've heard about in previous testimony, the encroachment of urban areas on former agriculture land, we have now seen an increase in litigation and administrative appeals in states that have exemptions for agriculture that are not consistent with the Clean Air Act. Without going into details, I'll just say that California and Idaho have been through this recently, and both states revised their rules to be consistent with the Clean Air Act. And in Oregon, November of 2005, the Environmental Protection Agency received a petition from a group of environmental organizations asking EPA to revoke their approval of Oregon's air quality program because of this exemption and the fact that it was not consistent with the Clean Air Act. In other words, for EPA to approve our entire air quality program, they have to find that we have adequate authorities required under the Clean Air Act, and the petition said that we don't have that authority. And in fact, EPA is now holding up revisions to our state program because of the petition, and they've informed us that if we don't get this problem corrected soon, they're going to have to start the process of revoking approval of our program. So it's very critical to us that Senate Bill 235 pass in order to address the petition and allow Oregon to keep delegation of the air program. Lisa is now going to tell you a little bit about the process that we went through to develop this bill.
For the record, I'm...
Dancy, before you do, I just want to clarify something you just said. In order to be in compliance, none of your programs in jeopardy, does it have to pass without the Dash 1 amendments?
Chair Avakian, no, the Dash 1 amendments are not required in order to resolve the petition.
If the Dash 1 amendments were adopted, would you still be able to be in compliance?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Hansen?
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. During the summer and fall of 2005, the EPA had been going through a process to begin to nationally look at emissions coming from confined animal feeding operations. And so ODA and DEQ had started discussions about this issue because it clearly was an emerging issue that was going to impact Oregon agriculture. And when we received the petition, we began the process of pulling together the industry to talk about what was going on with air quality, concerns about air quality nationally as it related to CAFOs. So in January of 2006, we brought a broad spectrum of the agricultural groups together to bring them up to speed on what was required in the Clean Air Act, the challenges that we face because of having a very broad agricultural exemption in Oregon, as well as we brought representatives from California up to talk about what happened in their process, what went right and what went wrong. And ultimately, what culminated from these efforts over about 8 months is what you have today in Senate Bill 235.
The bill has three main provisions. The most important is in Section 3. Section 3 authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt regulations for air emissions from agriculture as necessary to implement the Clean Air Act. So that's really the heart of the bill. Section 2 allows DEQ and ODA to enter into a memorandum of agreement or a memorandum of understanding, and this would essentially enable ODA to have the same authorities that the commission has and the department has to implement and enforce the rules. Does not prohibit the commission or DEQ from implementing the program, but directs us to enter into an agreement, and the agencies would work cooperatively on this program if the bill passes. And then Section 5
authorizes ODA to conduct research on techniques to reduce air emissions from agricultural operations. There are some additional provisions in the bill that do some housekeeping and cleanup. Briefly, the Clean Air Act can affect agriculture in a number of ways. The first would be if an agricultural operation were contributing to a violation of a federal air quality standard. In that case, the commission would be able to adopt regulations that require that operation to reduce emissions to the extent needed to meet the federal standard. Currently, we don't have that situation, but it is possible in the future we could have a violation of a federal standard where an agricultural operation was a significant contributor, and this bill would allow us to solve that problem. The second area would be in permitting. The Clean Air Act sets various thresholds for emission levels that would trigger permitting either for construction or permitting for operation. And if an agricultural operation were above those thresholds, then we would be required to permit them, and this bill would give us the authority to do so. Currently, at this time, my understanding is that we don't have any agricultural operations that are that large, but in the future, if one moved to Oregon, we would have the authorities necessary. Another area has to do with haze or visibility impairment in our wilderness areas and our national parks, and agricultural emissions do contribute to haze, and EPA has a requirement that over a long period of time, a 50-year period of time, all states reduce emissions to improve visibility in our national parks and wilderness areas. So at some point in a future update of our haze program, agricultural operations could be asked to reduce emissions, and this bill would give us the authority to do that. Just to be clear about what the bill doesn't do, it doesn't address odors from agricultural operations because odors are not regulated by the Clean Air Act. It does not authorize our agencies to be more stringent than the federal Clean Air Act. It does allow us to adopt regulations needed to implement the act, but not to go beyond that. And I'll give one specific example. The Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area is authorized under the National Scenic Act, not the Clean Air Act, and it doesn't get special protection under the Clean Air Act. So this bill would not authorize us to adopt regulations specifically to improve air quality in the gorge. But having said that, the gorge is surrounded by wilderness areas. There's the Mount Adams Wilderness Area, Mount Hood, Eagle Cap, and so efforts that we take to improve visibility in those areas will have indirect benefits for the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. The bill also does not create any specific timelines for DEQ and ODA to regulate agriculture, nor does it establish specific regulatory programs. It merely provides authority for the commission to address issues in the future if necessary to implement the act. And so just in closing, timing is critical. We really need to have this bill passed this session or we risk losing delegation of our air program. And this won't just affect agriculture. This will affect our entire air program. And could have far-reaching environmental and economic consequences for our state. And ultimately, we could even end up with litigation and having the courts impose a solution on us. And we'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Committee, anything?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Andy, thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy, I'd like to have a couple questions answered real quick, if you could. The Senate Bill 235 and the Dash 1 amendments vary in a couple of spots. One of them is that in the original Bill 235, it says the memorandum of understanding is a may. It's not prescriptive. In Dash 1, it says they shall enter into an agreement. That seemed to be quite a significant difference to me. One is permissive, one is directive. Are you aware of that difference?
Chair Vakian, Senator Bates, yes, I am. But if you look at all of the rest of the changes, you'll find that the may and shall is not a really significant difference.
If I could interject, I just left Legislative Council's office this morning, and unbeknownst to me even, there is an Oregon State statute that equates may with shall. And so in all the amendments Legislative Council is pumping out for us now, they're switching the language from shall to may, believing it means the same thing.
Oh, that's a significant difference.
Well, it is, but certainly, there is a statute on the book that says expressly the two mean the same thing.
You got that statute number?
I don't have it off the top of my head. Quite interesting, but
it is. Thank you.
It might be helpful.
Yeah, very helpful. Second, follow up, Mr. Chair. Could you, in a very simple way, explain to me the significant difference between the dash ones and the initial bill? And not only from the point of view what those differences are, but what do they mean on the ground? What do they mean to the industrial farms if you pass the dash ones compared to the 235s just without the dash ones? What is the real difference here?
Senator Bakken, Senator Bates, the two largest differences between the bills would have to do with large concentrated animal feeding operations in the Columbia River Gorge. The Dash 1 amendments would direct the Environmental Quality Commission to set standards, ambient air quality standards for hydrogen sulfide. Those would apply in the ambient air, not just to agriculture. Any facility that emitted those pollutants could be subject to regulation under those standards. So that's one major issue that we would be establishing. We would be required on a very short timeline to establish ambient air quality standards that would require probably a team of experts, including toxicologists and other resources that the department doesn't currently have, to set those standards. Once they were set, the Dash 1 also requires us then to establish emission standards to reduce emissions of hydrogen sulfide and ammonia from combined concentrated animal feeding operations. Under the bill without the amendments, we would only do that to the extent needed to meet the Clean Air Act, and that could happen over time, as I mentioned, under the regional haze requirements. But the Dash 1 would require us to do that on an accelerated time frame. And then the other difference would be the Columbia River Gorge. The bill would authorize us to establish air quality regulations for agriculture specifically to protect the gorge.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
And
what would be the penalty if you had set standards and those standards were exceeded in the gorge? What would be the penalty to the operation that was causing the pollution?
Chair Bakken and Senator Bates, I'm not sure I can answer that because it would really depend on the specific nature of the regulations. If we establish an emission standard for an operation, there are penalties can be up to $10,000 a day for violations for a very large organization or less for a smaller organization. It would depend on the nature of the violation, though. If it were a paperwork violation, it could be significantly less.
Follow-up, last question.
We'll hold you to that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And you may not be able to answer this, and others may have to do this for you, but if those regulations were in place and it was a large fine on a daily basis, is the technology available for these large industrial farms to meet those type of air quality standards that might be set up?
Chair Bakken and Senator Bates, there are a number of best management practices that have been developed. They vary depending on the type of agricultural operation and also the climate and the type of farming that is done. So we know there are a number of techniques to reduce emissions. Further research is needed to further quantify what those benefits would be. So if we established regulations with today's state of knowledge, we would have to develop a regulation that had quite a bit of flexibility in it for the development of technology and further understanding and quantification of what the emissions are.
Chair Bakken, might I follow up just a little bit? I think one of the big challenges we find as we talk about regulating air quality, it interacts so strongly with the regulation of water quality. And where we have put constraints on water quality, there have been impacts in terms of additional emissions into the air. And as you constrain one, then you, again, roll over and have additional constraints on land applications. And so they're very tightly intertwined, and it's very challenging in terms of balancing all the best management practices that could be used.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Mark Riskadal, Rebecca Hawk, and Michael Lang. And while you're coming up, committee, I want to finish this bill up today, so we may end up going 10, close to 5. If you can stay, I would appreciate it. And for everybody else who's coming up to testify, I need very much for you to get your points across, but to do it in a concise manner in about 2 minutes or less. Did everybody hear me?
Yep.
Head's nodding. Very good.
Chair Vakian, members of the committee, my name is Mark Riskadal, and I'm the director of NEDC, the Northwest Environmental Defense Center, at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland. In the short time I have before you today, I'd like to touch briefly on the history, the law, and the science behind the SB 235-1 amendments. In November of 2005, as was mentioned previously, my organization and a broad coalition of other conservation, public health, and farm worker organizations petitioned the U.S. EPA concerning Oregon's unlawful agricultural exemption. The same process was followed by citizen groups in California several years ago to deal with the only other existing agricultural exemption in the nation. The California legislature initially failed to act to address the citizen petition, and the U.S. EPA stepped in, as it was mandated to do under the Federal Clean Air Act, and asserted regulatory authority over emissions from agricultural activity in the state. The California legislature took notice, removed the exemption, and instituted a very prescriptive statutory approach to dealing with emissions from agricultural activity. Agricultural airsheds across the state of California, particularly those with the greatest concentration of industrial dairy activity, had degraded to the point that air quality in several rural California communities was considerably worse than air quality in Los Angeles. There's much to learn from the California example. The coalition of groups, tribal interests, and concerned citizens in support of SB 235-1 amendments has continued to grow since the process to remove Oregon's agricultural exemption was initiated nearly a year and a half ago. We've remained reasonable and flexible. We've not resorted to litigation, as concerned citizens in other states have done. And we've even conceded to an early request from the state agencies not to attend public working group meetings concerning this issue. We've not sought a prescriptive remedy to deal with the harms to environmental and public health that can result from agricultural emissions, and we feel that the science has evolved to the point that an open dialogue should take place concerning these harms. A wide range of other states already regulates emissions from agricultural activity. We're not saying that we have the answers concerning what form that regulation should take in Oregon, but we are saying it's well past time to start asking these questions.
Mr. Riskadal, I'm going to need you to go ahead and just summarize the rest because we do have your written testimony.
Okay, great. The thing that I'll just say at the very end is that the environmental, I want to stress the environmental harms that are associated with these emissions as well, because they are significant. Studies have shown that acidic conditions caused by high levels of ammonium nitrate and other particulate matter in the Columbia River Gorge in the winter can limit tree growth, reduce crop yields, increase the risk of insect infestations, harm sensitive lichens, and enable invasive species to choke out native plants and wildflowers. Those environmental harms are significant, and I'd be happy to speak to those more, and I'd also be happy to I presented along with my testimony from Dr. Green and Dr. Jaffe. These are two of the preeminent atmospheric scientists in the West, and they'd also be happy to answer questions if you've got any for them verbally or in writing. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Hawk Elwood?
Chair Avakian and committee, my name is, for the record, is Rebecca Hawk Elwood. I'm here on behalf of the Yakima Indian Nation today. I have been asked to read a statement from our tribal chairwoman, Levina Washines. Dear Chairman Avakian, the 14 confederated tribes and bands of the Yakima Nation have been working to ensure protection of the air, the sacred breath, the Halak Hashwit of the Columbia River Gorge since the year 2000. As you know, a significant problem of air pollution has been identified in the region by studies of the USDA Forest Service and by state projects from Oregon and Washington state agencies. In addition, the Yakima Nation, as part of an intertribal effort known as the Sacred Breath of the Columbia River Gorge Project, has worked with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, the Nez Perce Tribe, and the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs to form a partnership with the University of Washington to conduct research that would help determine specific source contributions to the air pollution problem in the gorge. The findings of University of Washington atmospheric scientist Dr. Dan Jaffe determined that sources on the eastern end of the Columbia River Gorge significantly contribute to the visibility problem and to observed damage to the cultural resources in the gorge. Based on backward trajectory analysis and chemical composition analysis, it was determined that emissions from Three Mile Canyon Farm specifically are a major contributor to the air pollution problems in the gorge during the incidence of poor air quality. A bi-state study has already determined that visibility in the National Scenic Area is impaired 95% of the time. A USDA Forest Service study has already determined determined that atmospheric deposition of ammonia and nitrogen is having an extremely detrimental effect on lichens and suggests extreme harm to human health and ecosystem. As native people of this region, we live closer to the land and water of this region. Our people, in an EPA fish consumption study, it was determined that we consume 10 times the amount of fish from the Columbia as does the general population. We are deeply concerned about the impact that emissions from Eastern Gorge polluters, such as the large mega farm in Boardman, Oregon, known as Three Mile Canyon Farms, has on the human health and the ecosystem of the region. We are doing our part to provide research and collect data that is helping to determine the impact of this pollution. We've done this in conjunction with the EPA. We are now depending on this legislative body to do its part in acting responsibly to protect all people and the fragile ecosystem that sustains us. The Treaty of 1855 reserved the rights of the Yakima Nation for hunting, fishing, and gathering in all usual and accustomed places, as we have done from time immemorial. Our native homeland, which is not limited to the present-day political boundaries and spans throughout the basin, is severely impacted by the poor air quality in the region. The damage to our traditional foods, the plants, the aquatic life, the birds, and animals is a great continued loss to our people and poses health threats to everyone. Allowing continued damage to these natural and cultural resources is a violation of our treaty rights. We are working again with scientists from the University of Washington to determine specific effects of damage from ammonia and nitrogen on the ancient petroglyphs and pictographs that line the Gorge Canyon walls. We've already lost 70% of these cultural resources due to inundation from the dams along the Columbia River. To continue to further allow the desecration of these sacred, spiritual, religious, and cultural resources through deposition of air pollutants is nothing less than a furtherance of the genocide of our people. We urge the state legislative body to act responsibly and approve amendments to Senate Bill 235 that would help protect air quality in the Columbia River Gorge by requiring the adoption of air quality standards for industrial agricultural operations in Oregon. Many large agricultural operations, such as Three Mile Canyon Farms, qualify as a major source of air pollution under the Clean Air Act. However, these massive operations currently operate unregulated as a direct result of Oregon's agricultural exemption. Industrial agriculture poses a major threat to air quality in the Columbia River Gorge by contributing to haze and acid rain. More than minimal compliance with federal law is required to protect human health, ecosystem health, and cultural resources. We ask that the state of Oregon consider their options as a matter of environmental justice and act to ensure, quote, a healthy environment in which to live, learn, and work, from environmental justice, compliance, and enforcement by EPA. Thank you for your consideration of our comments. Sincerely, Levina Washines, Tribal Councilwoman, Chairwoman of the Yakima Nation.
Thank you. Mr. Lang.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Lang. I'm Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. I have written testimony, which I will summarize. I also had some exhibits that I'd like entered into the record, including strategies for reducing gas emissions from dairy farms. Also, a photographic sample of haze in the Eastern Gorge from a Forest Service study, a summary of the differences between SB 235 and the Dash 1 amendments, also two articles related to air pollution in the Columbia River Gorge, and lastly, a summary of all of the scientific studies conducted in the Columbia River Gorge to measure air pollution. Friends of the Columbia Gorge is here to support the Dash 1 amendments to SB 235. We really appreciate the committee taking some of its time to hear this bill and to hear these amendments. Friends of the Columbia Gorge has 4,000 members dedicated to the protection and enhancement of the gorge. The gorge is certainly one of America's natural scenic treasures, abundant resources, over 800 species of flowering plants, 5 separate ecosystems, over 300 species of birds, cultural resources dating from over 11,000 years of human habitation. All are worthy of protection by the state and also the federal government. The Columbia River Gorge is protected as a national scenic area by an act of Congress. That act of Congress is incorporated into state law. Also, the states of Oregon and Washington Washington have an interstate compact that pledges to carry out the provisions of the National Scenic Area Act. And this is a real important point as well, that it requires all state agencies to carry out their respective functions in accordance with the National Scenic Area Act. And the respective functions that are relevant today is a DEQ's duty to protect air quality and protect the natural scenic wonder that we know as the Columbia River Gorge. The Scenic Area Act passed 20 years ago. To date, no action has been taken by the DEQ to protect air quality in the Columbia River Gorge and protect its resources. We believe Senate Bill 235-1 amendments is a step in the right direction for the DEQ to do that. We also believe it's a required step. After all, the Scenic Area Act requires the protection of these resources and, again, requires the DEQ to carry out its respective functions in accordance with that act, and that also includes protecting air quality. There's a summary of the air quality studies that is in my testimony. I won't go over it right now, but air quality, the record shows, the experts agree, is significantly degraded. Something needs to be done. Sources east of the Columbia River Gorge have been found to contribute substantially to air pollution in the gorge, and we know some of those sources identified by the experts include a large CAFO, concentrated animal feeding operation in Boardman, and also, of course, PG's coal-fired power plant that is uncontrolled for sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. It's probably these two sources that contribute the most, the greatest amount, to air pollution and haze in the gorge. And again, that's been substantiated by recent scientific studies. The agencies...
I'll need you to get pretty close to wrapping it up.
Okay, to the
origin. I really meant the 2 minutes when I said it.
Okay,
I really meant the 2 minutes I'll wrap it up. So let's get to a conclusion.
The Dash 1 amendments would keep the responsibility for protecting and enacting rules to protect air quality where it rightfully belongs, with the EQC and the Department of Environmental Quality. That's a major difference. Secondly, it would require setting up standards for regulating ammonia and hydrogen sulfide. Thirdly, it would require the EQC to do something, to start a process to enact rules to address air pollution from CAFOs. Those are major differences. SB 235 is a do-nothing bill. Dash 1 amendments actually take some positive steps in the right direction. The materials that I provided you show that there are known strategies for reducing air pollution from agricultural sources.
Okay.
And we would ask the committee to please support the Dash 1 amendments. Thank
very
you.
Very good. Thank you very much, the three of you. Ivan Molesky, Katie Fast, Jonathan Graca.
Chair Vaki and members of the committee, out of respect for your time, I will just submit my written comments for the record here. But suffice it to say that the Sierra Club finds itself standing in support with Senator George and Representative Boquist today on supporting the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 235. Ooh. That's what I thought I heard them say. Quite compelling.
That's a big thing. Did you hear what he just said?
I heard it.
That's no, I just didn't know if everybody heard that. He made a
I
specific
said it
point.
Kind of quickly, I understand.
Didn't you? All right.
That's an important point. And so that's really it. And I think that one last key point I'd like to leave you with is that...
You better put your name on the record for a key point.
The governor has recommended an increase in DEQ's budget to do studies of air quality in the Columbia Gorge. Unfortunately, the legislature is looking at significantly reducing what the governor's proposed for gorge air quality. That's a very significant step, and I think that that's the path we're going to take. It especially means that we need to look at real policies, such as the Dash 1 amendments, that direct the EQC to begin gathering the data necessary to make the real changes to help protect small farmers, air quality, and public health. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Fast?
Thank you, Chair Avakian and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. It's my pleasure today to testify in support of Senate Bill 235, and also I'd like to add in opposition of the Dash 1 amendments. Along with my testimony, which I will quickly summarize, I'm also including a copy of the petition that you've heard mentioned today that has started this whole process. In response to the petition that was filed to EPA by groups that you've heard, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, Friends of the Columbia Gorge, and also the Sierra Club, the Department of Agriculture put together a work group that had numerous stakeholders from the agricultural community that I served on as well. We made recommendations to the Department of Agriculture and to DEQ to address this petition and to do what the petition requests. And that's what Senate Bill 235 does. It revokes our agricultural exemption that's in place now. It allows DEQ and Department of Agriculture to regulate agricultural operations for Title V and also for pre-construction permits. So it meets the petitioners and the environmental community's requests. With that, summarize.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'll try and stick to 2 minutes. My name is Jonathan Graysa, and I'm from Hood River, Oregon. I work with Hood River Valley Residents Committee, which is a nonprofit representing about 150 families in the Hood River Valley. And our mission is to preserve farm and forest land and build livable communities. I'm going to just focus on 2 points here. One, there's evidence that's shown that the nitrogen-rich emissions are impacting the canary in the mine, lichen. And this evidence has also shown that it's limiting tree growth and decreasing crop yields. Right now, obviously, Senator Pisanski knows Measure 37 is hurting farmers in Hood River Valley, and there's also labor shortages and overseas competition. This acid rain and issues from large areas like Three Mile Canyon are just going to be having higher impacts on Hood River Valley's agriculture. Second point is, other states have increased regulations on industrial dairy operations, and Oregon's current agricultural exemption is a loophole for more and larger industrial scale farms to move to Oregon and exacerbate issues already raised. So I'm asking you to please support Senate Bill 235-1.
Very good. Thank you all very much. Jim Welsh, Jason Hale, Peter Cornelison.
Chair Vakian, committee members, I'm Jim Welsh, representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association. And we support Senate Bill 235 as written, and we're opposing the Dash 1 for all the reasons you've heard from Farm Bureau and from DEQ and ODA. So we hope that you will pass that out as is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Hale. Very nice to have you with us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Good afternoon, Chair Avakian and members of the committee. My name is Jason Hale. I'm currently the mayor of Madras. I want to be very brief because I'm well aware of the value of your time. I am here on behalf of the city of Madras in favor of Senate Bill 235 with the proposed Dash 1 amendment. If passed, as right now, it ties the hands of state to address emissions from industrial farms any further than what the Clean Air Act allows. Senate Bill 235 enacts the Clean Air Act, but the Clean Air Act does not address emissions from industrial farms. My constituents in Madras are concerned with these farms getting closer and closer to cities. They want the assurance that their interests, in particular public health, quality of life, and property value, will be protected with adequate safeguards. Regardless of land use regulations, we want to ensure that the people of Madras are protected as well as the rest of the state. In plain words, I want to make very clear that I want Madras to be protected. I want to make sure that the water is kept clean. Recently, we've had a feedlot locate 1 mile south of Madras, and with a very light rain, it took a river of effluent, down into town to our Fairgrounds Road and almost reached our skate park. And we need regulations to help keep people safe. Please protect the people that live in our cities. Help protect places like the Southwest Music School. Help protect places like the Molalla River School District, the University of Oregon in Eugene, the future schools of our 3-year-old children, and the Shakespearean Festival in Ashland. This is important to me and important to the citizens of Madras. Thank you, Chairman Avakian, and members of the committee for your careful consideration in this matter.
Nice job.
Don't think we didn't realize that you did a little research with all those schools that you commented on the end from each of our districts. One from each district. Thank you, Mayor.
My pleasure.
Right ahead.
My name is Peter Cornelison. I live in Hood River. Thanks for this opportunity to talk to you today. Two seasons of the year, our air flows in from the Pacific, and it gives us that great windsurfing condition. But the other two seasons, fall and winter, the air flows easterly, or it flows to the west, and we get the air basically from a huge air basin, which goes up as far as Spokane, goes over to the Snake River. And so we get all those people's air and all the pollution that comes with it. And that has contributed to the headlines in the Oregonian that you probably read about, namely the fact that Columbia River Gorge has air quality at times that is equal to the smog in L.A. and the East Coast. So, you know, dealing with that huge air basin is a big job. But the easy thing is that there are two major polluters here in Oregon that you can deal with, and that have been shown from the preliminary scientific studies that they are contributing the most pollution. And Three Mile Canyon Farms is the one that's up for your consideration today. So I would just urge you to take that into account and please pass that measure. In closing, when you're dealing with Measure 37, I'd appreciate it if you'd read this passage, which I attached. It's a wonderful thing from the Oregon Owner's Manual from Solvent. It just talks about how beautiful this state is. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Committee, are there any questions? Seeing none? Okay. Thank you very much. Donna Hibbert, Joan Carter, Lorraine Stewart.
Senator Avakian, members of the committee, my name is Donna Hippert, and I come before you this afternoon to support Senate Bill 235-1 amendment and also to list some of the agencies and entities and organizations that are in support of this amendment, illustrating the broad support of this amendment and the feeling that Senate Bill 235 without the amendment is inadequate. Some of these groups have submitted testimony, oral and written, to you today. Some of them haven't, but I would like you to take into consideration that the combined membership rosters and the constituencies of these organizations number in the hundreds of thousands across Oregon. We have the City of Madras, the Friends of the Columbia Gorge, Oregon Rural Action, United Farm Workers, Columbia River Keeper, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Sierra Club, Trout Unlimited, Friends of Family Farmers, Oregon Wild, Northwest Environmental Defense Center, Oregon Farm Workers Ministry, the Rural Organizing Project, Oregon Toxics Alliance, Hell's Canyon Preservation Council, and the Yakima Nation. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman Avakian and the members of the committee. My name is Joan Carter from McMinnville, Oregon. I am a member of Friends of the Columbia River Gorge, the Nature Conservancy, Oregon League of Conservation Voters, the American Hiking Society, and Oregon Wild. I urge your support of strong air quality protections for the passage of Senate Bill 235 with its amendment, and endorse that amendment because it adds greater power to the bill, and it stipulates stronger air quality protections by authorizing the Oregon DEQ to regulate large agricultural businesses, especially as their operations have an ever-increasing negative effect on our Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. Many Oregonians enjoy one of the most exquisite views and landscapes in the lower 48 states. Beautiful vistas, trails, and highways stun all of those visiting the gorge each year, whether they are a trucker, a cyclist, a hiker or a picnicker or just passing through to have dinner in Portland. We're lucky we're not charged admission to drive through this crown jewel. But the gorge is at risk in having a law on the books which exempts all agricultural operations from meeting the highest air quality standards spelled out in the Clean Air Act. Yet 150 miles east of Portland, a factory-scale operation, the Three Mile Canyon Farms, generates health-endangering emissions, which, combined with emissions from the coal-fired PG&E Boardman plant, drift down river and degrade this exquisite area which Oregonians enjoy. I urge the adoption of this bill and its amendment so that all stakeholders can design the solution at the state level so that the Environmental Protection Agency does not have to step in and wield federal mandates. In the words of the late astronaut Krista McAuliffe, who said, "I touch the future, I am a teacher." Each of you on this committee is not only a lawmaker, you are a teacher in that you can affect the future of this great state. For your fellow citizens and for your colleagues in this legislative body, I urge you to vote this legislation through today and in the Senate vote to come. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Senator Vakian and committee, I'm Lorraine Stewart. I live here in Salem. I was born over 80 years ago in Iowa, one of the centers of agriculture, and I would like to take a different approach and suggest that you, all of us, should think what we have been doing in agriculture in the United States. We've separated the animals from the land. We've fed animals corn, which they were not born in nature. Nature has given us a tremendous amount. And I think that we need to protect nature and follow along with the way agriculture should go instead of all of these approaches which are like industries which are ruining nature.
All right. Thank you very much, the three of you. Appreciate your testimony. Jim Cron, Louis Casimir, and Dave Nelson. Committee, there are just two people left after this panel to testify, and then we will stand at ease for just a few moments and then move to a work session.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Nelson. I represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and the Oregon Seed Council. And I suppose to some extent have some responsibility for the Three Mile Canyon Farms, and that I arranged for then-Governor John Kitzhaber to call the board of directors in their meeting of the Tillamook Creamery Association and to urge them to locate their expansion plant in Oregon, not in Wyoming or Idaho or other places that were buying and offering very significant and lucrative inducements to locate that plant in those states. We started out about 8 or now 10 months, going on a year ago, to correct some deficiencies in Oregon's air quality laws dealing with agricultural, and you've all heard that. I think that to a certain extent the bill is being hijacked with the Dash 1 amendments to expand in the Section 3 sub A to reach out and regulate hydrogen sulfide emitters, which includes all of the paper plants and the what we used to call Pebble Springs power generation facility at the east end of the gorge and so on. So we would support the SB 235 version without the Dash 1 amendments, and I would introduce Mr. Jim Cron, who's the executive director of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, who has done a lot of work with the emissions and air quality related issues on dairy production.
Senator Vakian and members of the committee, my name is Jim Cron. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I've scribbled on my sheets here, so bear with me. I've tried to reduce this so that I can be within 2 minutes. In August of 06, the dairy industry directed staff, meaning me, to develop a Northwest Dairy Standards Program with Washington State. Included in these standards is a voluntary best management practice program for air emissions. The dairy industry will be working with ODA, DEQ, EPA, OSU. In addition, will include groups who have special interest in these areas to develop this program. This all-encompassing program includes the areas of environment, both water and air, labor, animal care, food safety, and energy conservation. This Northwest effort will include 830 producers in Oregon and Washington. This is the first program of its kind in the United States. From a national perspective, the United States dairy industry has committed $6 million to the U.S. EPA study for dairies. I have served on the U.S. Dairy Industry Environmental Task Force since its inception. This task force has been the group that has moved this program forward. Land-grant universities, under the oversight of U.S. EPA, are conducting this research. There are four key parts to this program: developing accurate baselines on specific emissions from all parts of a dairy operation, use of a process-based model so that the baselines developed can be overlaid onto any dairy in the United States, determine impacts of the different types of air emissions, develop mitigation practices and technology. The study will be completed in 2010. August 9th through the 11th of 2005, the National Institute of Occupation Safety and Health conducted a study on Three Mile Canyon Dairy in Boardman. We've heard that dairy mentioned numerous times. I have provided you with a copy of the results of that study. The study focused on dust, ammonia, hydrogen sulfide. The study was conducted due to a confidential request. If you take a look, if you get an opportunity, on the third page of this document, it says what NIOSH found, and there's 4 points. The concentration of ammonia was within recommended levels. Number two, the concentration of hydrogen sulfide was within recommended levels. Number three, some employees had upper airway irritation symptoms such as tearing eyes, coughing, and sneezing, which were attributed to road dust. And number four, employees did not always use protective equipment provided. And it's important for you to understand that this is the largest dairy in the state of Oregon. Oregon dairy producers, with dairy producers throughout the United States, realize that air emissions must be addressed. However, it is vital that any regulation developed in this area must be based on sound science and effective technology, not emotions. The dairy farmers of Oregon support Senate Bill 235 as written. Thank you.
Chair Avakian, my name is Louis Kasner. I'm the owner of Rick Rial Dairy. We're located in Polk County, and I would first like to just address the letter written to you from Mr. Paul Small, stating that he had his house appraised for $400,000. I get along with every one of our neighbors across the street. We have 9 neighbors directly across the street. Those houses have been bought and sold throughout the 17 years that we've been there. Mr. Small's home was only 1,800 square feet, was built 45 years ago, and it floods, gets water in it every time the Rick Rial Creek comes up. And he threatened to sue us as a dairy owner for the differences in this. Okay, so as a dairyman, and I'm one of the only dairymen here in the room, we've implemented the best management practices that Department of Ag and the Dairy Farmers Association have laid out. We volunteered for the EPA study. We do free tours for the school children. We've had up to almost 3,500 kids already through the dairy this year. We do this free of charge for our school kids. I have 20 families that work for me. We are a family-run business. My father-in-law and I own this, even though it's perceived as a mega dairy. We've done everything that the law has asked us to do so far. Our record is public record. We've made mistakes. We've corrected them. And right now we're planning on making almost a $7 million investment on our property that is very atypical to the dairy industry. And I don't think that it's expected that every dairyman be asked to do this. We're partnering with an investment company to build a methane digester because I know some of the factors as to where we live. This is only going to benefit everybody. Our dairy is always open to anybody who's got any questions and concerns, including anybody who may oppose the dairy. I'd be more than willing to show you guys around and show all the different paperwork and different stuff that we have to do in order to maintain just the legal end of it today. So I would suggest that we pass Senate Bill 235 just the way it is.
Very good. Thank you, committee. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen, for being here. There are two folks left to testify, Catherine Van Natta and Colleen Callahan. Is Ms. Callahan still here? Oh, take your time. Ms. Van Natta, you can start.
Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. We support Senate Bill 235 as introduced, and we oppose the Dash 1 amendments dated 313. We first saw those amendments today. Those amendments do also regulate the pulp and paper industry. Just a comment about hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is also commonly known as sewer gas. It is also what you smell coming from wastewater treatment plants. It is what you smell near craft paper mills. Also, it is a commonly occurring substance that you find varied across the landscape wherever you have organic matter that's decomposing. And so I'd like to say that we do oppose the Dash 1s. There hasn't been any conversation with the industry about the EQC setting a new standard for H2S. We believe that that is addressed. Concerns with this specific air toxics are addressed in the air toxics program that the DEQ does run on air toxics. And an ambient benchmark has been set and approved by the EQC for H2S. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Van Natta. Ms. Callahan, you get the last word.
I'll try and keep it short. My name is Colleen Callahan, and I brought my one-year-old daughter, Isabella, here with me today, and I'm thankful to be speaking today in support of the SB 235-1 amendments. I grew up in Klamath County, and I appreciate the importance of small family farms to the cultural soul of this state. 2 years ago, my friends and neighbors and co-workers at the Henley High School District, who are small farmers, fought to keep an industrial pig farm from coming into their neighborhood. The impact on the quality of life would have been profound, and the Senate Bill 235 would not do enough to protect the people that I care about in the county. From future possibilities of large industrial farms, which in no way resemble family farms that exist there now. I now live in Multnomah County, and I'm raising my daughter here in Portland. I've been hiking the gorge with her since she was 2 months old, and as a country girl, I need the relief of nature to feel whole, and I hike there often. It's alarming to me to know that there is acid deposition in the gorge that is some of the worst in the nation, that the rain that falls there and the fog that lays on the plants is sometimes as acidic as vinegar, and it falls regularly in the gorge. 235 does not sufficiently address this without the Dash 1 amendments. And I also want to just, I don't have the DEQ fact sheet with me, but the DEQ fact sheet for Senate Bill 235 actually states that they don't expect that any it will have any real impact on farms right now, that it will not affect them, and that they implemented it to avoid federal sanctions for highway funds to the state, coming to the state. And I also want to ask the committee to consider a scale of how the amendments are going to impact people across the state, as opposed to if you don't do it. I'm not being clear, I'm sorry, but there's a small number of people who stand to gain from the Senate Bill 235 passing as it stands. And there's a large majority of people who will be affected by the amendments and improving their quality of life, especially as industrial farms come into the state. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both very much for your testimony and for bringing your child with you. That's nice. Very well behaved through a long hearing like this. Better than the committee most of the time. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235, and the committee will stand at ease for a few minutes.
Red monkey flies at dawn, over.
Split on.
Okay, the committee is back. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 235, and we'll entertain any motions on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 235.
Senator Pozanski moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 235. Committee, is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I oppose the motion, Mr. Chair. I think Senate Bill 235 is a consensus bill, and the bill we should be passing. If amendment motion to pass amendment passes, I will, which I'm going to oppose, I also will oppose the bill.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair,
Bates.
It's a tough call for me. I've gone back and forth on this all week, and I really was looking forward to testimony today that would clear the path for me making a decision. I still have some questions in my mind. Key question for me being, how is this going to affect some industrialized farms? The state will actually close them down. I didn't hear testimony that, in fact, it would. And so I'm going to go with the dash ones on this. With some reservations. I also was had some reservations here at the last moment here. This might be affecting our pulp and paper mills also, which would be a further concern to me. But having said that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go with the dash ones.
Matt, we're going to do an oral roll call on this and on the bill, so if you could do a roll call on the motion before us, which is to adopt the dash one amendments to 235.
Yes.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Pozanski?
Aye.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Rock?
Aye. And with that, the motion carries and the dash ones are adopted. And if I could have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 235 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Pozanski moves Senate Bill 235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Committee, any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I'd just like to clarify. You had made the statement that your conversation with LC was Shall and May was being interpreted the same, and I think we need to get on the record that there is a difference. The shall nots and the may nots are in statute, and I'd like, you know, you've got the paper in front of you, not me, but I think that the person in the LC may have given you some bad advice.
Well, I don't know that... I don't know that that is necessarily true or not, and I don't know what I have before me where it came from. So what I'm going to do is pass it down to you, and you can put on the record whatever you would like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pozanski went and talked to Ann Boss at Legislative Council, and this is the statutory construction language that is legislative style, Chapter 1, also is adopted in our rules of the Senate. And it says that to impose an obligation to act, you shall. To confer a right, power, or privilege, use may. Do not use shall to grant permission or may to impose a duty. It then goes on to say that shall not and may not mean the same thing.
It's a fair point, Senator, and I'm not sure if what you just read into the record is consistent with or in conflict with what we looked at earlier that's in the actual volume of the ORS. But I would agree with you that if there... that if that point is not clear within Legislative Council's office, that that's an issue that needs to be taken up on the House side with this bill. I think it's a very fair point.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, I've been mostly quiet, and I'm just a simple country boy from Southern Oregon. This is the first time I've ever been to the big city. But there's a part of this bill that I just don't understand. For years, we have been working for a agriculture labor bill. And it was Senator Beyer and I who worked hard in one of the special sessions to pass what was then the first attempt to pass a Farm Labor Relations Act since the McCall era. And we got it through, and some of you recall, every seat in the gallery was packed. There were 600 people out in the estimated to have been out in the lobby. And it was a very hostile bill. It was a very hostile time, and then the bill actually passed. And what the bill did very quickly was the bill stopped secondary boycotts, which put us in line with the Federal Labor Relations Act. And it also prevented harvest strikes, among other things. The bill went through with all the politics. It was ended up being vetoed. And flash forward to last summer, because Three Mile Farms was unionized without the farm labor bill being passed through here. It's my understanding, and I could be wrong, that that same labor organization is now urging pressure upon the vendors of Three Mile Farms to also unionize. And while that might not have a huge bearing on Oregon, per se, it's certainly part of what's happening nationally, as nationally the Agriculture Farm Labor Bill is coming up for some debate, probably in future Congresses in upcoming years. Here's what I don't understand. What I don't understand is on the Northwest Environmental Defense Center, you have the United Farm Workers of America, AFL-CIO, urging for a Dash 1 amendment that's going to damage Three Mile Farms. Politically, what I don't understand is we have a union who typically supports one political party, an environmental establishment that usually supports one particular party, and the top brass at Three Mile Canyon who also supports that same political party. So someone has got to tell me, is it going to be the position of this one particular political party and all the stuff that I've just aforementioned, do they want Three Mile Canyon Farms or not? Because if we don't want it in the state, then just shut it down. If we do want it in the state, then there's got to be some consistency here. Now, I know that's a 30,000 view foot, but as I'm looking here and having been around this building for so long, I don't see a consistency when it comes to whether or not we want Three Mile Farms in the state of Oregon or not. And so, therefore, I'm going to be a no vote.
Well, and I can appreciate your comments. I'd like you to clarify a little bit more for the record so that I understand where you were headed with that, on what you meant by political party and what you meant by the relationship between that and the unions.
Sure. If you look at the CNEs, and I don't mean this to be political. I mean this to be policy. But the CNEs are typically that the Democratic Party of Oregon receives substantial support from the AFL-CIO. And that's, I don't want to make this political per se.
No, what I want you to clarify is, I would hope that you are not implicitly saying that that would affect the actions of the members on this committee.
No, that's, and thank you for that clarification. No, and I don't mean that at all to the committee. Certainly, that's not this issue. has been here before any of us were elected and will be here after we're all gone. That's not the point. So thank you. I don't certainly want to impugn anything here, but there's a consistency issue here about the role of Three Mile Farms, the role of the community in Oregon, and the trade-off that the Dash One is asking us to make between Three Mile Farms, the workers at Three Mile Farms, the economic development of Three Mile Farms, and the environmental community and the gorge. That is the spectrum here that is not consistent.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bates.
I feel that I must answer your position. First off, I'm a Democrat. When were we ever accused of being organized or consistent?
I think you'll get a unanimous vote from the committee.
That's the first one. Secondly, my decision was driven by testimony I've heard today, and strictly on the basis of what I think is best on an environmental basis and a health basis for people around this area, around 3 Mile and around the gorge. That's my decision has been driven on. I fully understand the difficulty that large dairy operations, industrial operations may have, and I have some sympathy for them. I did not hear, as I said earlier, this is going to cause them to leave the state. Maybe it will. I have not heard that testimony today. It'll make their life more difficult, I'm certain. Harder to make a profit and harder to keep going. But I think we have a responsibility. As the very last testifier spoke to us, I was kind of moved by what she said. And that's the reason I voted the way I voted, not for any political purpose whatsoever.
Mr. Chair, let me just clarify. That's why I kept saying I'm not saying this is a Republican-Democrat thing. Please understand me. What this is there's a consistency issue here between something that started back in the 1970s with the United Farm Workers, and the United Farm Workers then lobbying, Cesar Chavez lobbying this very building under Tom McCall, under creation of a Fair Labor Relations Act that has got mired in politics for 30 years around here, and we've never addressed it, and we would all agree with that. And now the change of 3 Mile Farms, making a change on that 30 years, 35 years now later, in relationship to what I'm reading here in the testimony. That's my point, and it may be a very difficult, slurry point, but it's just, I guess, what you call some kind of legislative history.
It's okay. Fair enough discussion. Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I also put on the record is that the reason I supported the Dash Ones over the bill as it is because the shall versus the may. I do believe that the Environmental Quality Commission and the Department of Agriculture need to enter into a memorandum of understanding as compared to being permissive. Clearly, that is a bright line, the difference between the two bills. Regarding the issues that Senator Atkinson has brought up, I would just say they're not germane for the bill that we have before us. We great to maybe at some other time have a conversation as to why that is, and maybe we aren't the ones here at this dais to be able to answer that question to his satisfaction. But the reality is that my position on this bill is based on my belief that those two agencies of the state need to enter into a memorandum, and it shouldn't be permissive. And we clearly have gotten clarification from the LC that what shall means is shall. That is an obligation. May is permissive. And I don't think that it follows the needs of what we want as a state. Lastly, I'll say I will agree with what Senator Bates has said. There is no testimony, and I don't expect this to put 3 Mile out of business. I don't think that they will find that to be the case. What I do expect is that any good business is going to comply with the law. We have a study that was done that says they were in compliance. And so what, if any, effect it's going to have on them, who knows? But the reality, based on the impact that we're seeing as to pollution in certain areas that are pocketed, such as the gorge, we need to be looking at a more global fix and make certain that all practices within the state, whatever type of business it is that it is not unjustly impacting the quality of life for all of us.
committee. I appreciate the candid discussion, and I appreciate you staying late to get the bill finished. The motion before us is to put 235 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Matt, would you call the roll?
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Plaski?
Aye.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Obama?
Aye. The motion carries. Senator Prochansky, would you be kind enough to carry the bill?
Mr. Yes. Chair.
Senator Byer.
Have you finished the vote?
Yes, sir.
Let me gavel it down, and then we'll wait. The motion carries. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 235. And before I adjourn, Senator Byer.
Serve notice of minority report.
And we are adjourned.
It actually takes two.